The federal budget that year was less than $7 million. The critics seem to be right when they conclude that the costs were not just daunting, but also prohibitively expensive. The more one thought about such numbers, in effect, the more one realized that further thought was futile. There is some evidence that reasoning of just this sort was going on in Jefferson's mind at this time, changing him from an advocate for emancipation to a silent and fatalistic procrastinator. The flaw in such reasoning, however, would have been obvious to any accountant or investment banker with a modicum of Hamiltonian wisdom. For the chief virtue of a gradual approach was to extend the cost of compensation over several decades so that the full bill never landed at one time or even on one generation. In the scheme that St. George Tucker proposed, for example, purchases and payments would continue for the next century, delaying the arrival of complete emancipation to be sure, but significantly reducing the impact of the current costs by spreading them into the distant future. The salient question in 1790 was not the total cost, but with an amortized debt, the initial cost of capitalizing a national fund, often called a sinking fund, for such purposes. The total debt inherited from the states and the federal government in 1790 was $77.1 million. A reasonable estimate of the additional costs for capitalizing a gradual emancipation program would have increased the national debt to about $125 million. While daunting, these numbers were not fiscally impossible, and they became more palatable when folded into a total debt package produced by a war for independence. The other major impediment, equally daunting as the compensation problem at first glance, even more so upon reflection, was the relocation of the freed slaves. Historians have not studied the feasibility of this feature as much as the compensation issue, preferring instead to focus on the racial prejudices that required its inclusion, apparently fearing that their very analysis of the problem might be construed as an endorsement of the racist and segregationist attitudes prevalent at the time. Two unpalatable but undeniable historical facts must be faced. First, that no emancipation plan without this feature stood the slightest chance of success, and second, that no model of a genuinely biracial society existed anywhere in the world at that time, nor had any existed in recorded history. The gradual emancipation schemes adopted in the northern states never needed to face this question squarely, because the black population there remained relatively small. South of the Potomac was a different matter altogether, since approximately 90% of the total black population resided there. Any national plan for gradual emancipation needed to transform this racial demography by relocating at least a significant portion of that population elsewhere. But where? The subsequent failure of the American Colonization Society and the combination of logistical and economic difficulties in the colony of Liberia exposed the impracticality of any mass migration back to Africa. The more viable option was transportation to the unsettled lands of the American West, along the lines of the Indian Removal Program adopted over 40 years later. In 1790, however, despite the presumptive dreams of a continental empire, the Louisiana Purchase remained in the future, and the vast trans-Mississippi region continued under Spanish ownership. While the creation of several black homelands or districts east of the Mississippi was not beyond contemplation, it was mentioned in private correspondence by a handful of anti-slavery advocates, it was just as difficult to envision then as it is difficult to digest now. More than the question of compensation, then, the relocation problem was perilously close to insoluble. To top it all off and add yet another layer of armament to the institution of slavery, any comprehensive plan for gradual emancipation could only be launched at the national level under the auspices of a federal government fully empowered to act on behalf of the long-term interests of the nation as a whole. Much like Hamilton's financial plan, any effective emancipation initiative conjured up fears of the much-dreaded consolidation that the Virginians, more than anyone else, found so threatening. Indeed, for at least some of the Virginians, the deepest dread and greatest threat was that federal power would be used in precisely this way. All the constitutional arguments against the excessive exercise of government power at the federal level then kicked in to make any effort to shape public policy more problematic. Any attempt to take decisive action against slavery in 1790, given all these considerations, confronted great, perhaps impossible, odds. The prospects for success were remote at best. But then the prospects for victory against the most powerful army and navy in the world had been remote in 1776, as had the likelihood that 13 separate and sovereign states would create a unified republican government in 1787. Great leadership had emerged in each previous instance to transform the improbable into the inevitable. Ending slavery was a challenge on the same gigantic scale as these earlier achievements. Whether even a heroic level of leadership stood any chance was uncertain because, and here was the cruelest irony, the effort to make the revolution truly complete seemed diametrically opposed to remaining a united nation. One person stepped forward to answer the challenge, unquestionably the oldest, probably the wisest member of the revolutionary generation. In point of fact, he was actually a member of the preceding generation, the grandfather among the fathers. Benjamin Franklin was very old and very ill in March of 1790. He had been a fixture on the American scene for so long and had outlived so many contemporaries. He had once traded anecdotes with Cotton Mather and was a contemporary of Jonathan Edwards, that reports of his imminent departure lacked credibility. His last act seemed destined to go on forever. He was an American immortal. If a 20th-century photographer had managed to commandeer a time machine and travel back to record the historic scenes in the Revolutionary era, Franklin would have been present in almost every picture. In Philadelphia during the Continental Congress and the signing of the Declaration of Independence, in Paris to draft the wartime treaty with France, and then almost single-handedly assist to John Adams, conclude the peace treaty with Great Britain, in Philadelphia again for the Constitutional Convention and the signing of the Constitution. Even without the benefit of photography, Franklin's image, with its bemused smile, its bespectacled but twinkling eyes, its ever-bald head framed by gray hair flowing down to his shoulders, was more famous and familiar to the world than the face of any other American of the age. What Voltaire was to France, Franklin was to America, the symbol of mankind's triumphal arrival at modernity. When the two great philosopher kings embraced amid the assembled throngs of Paris, the scene created a sensation, as if the gods had landed on earth and declared the dawning of enlightenment. The greatest American scientist, the most deft diplomat, the most accomplished prose stylist, the sharpest wit, Franklin defied all the categories by inhabiting them all with such distinction and nonchalant grace. Over a century before Horatio Alger, he had invented the role and called it Poor Richard, the original self-taught homespun American with an uncanny knack for showing up where history was headed and striking a folksy pose that then dramatized the moment forever, holding the kite as the lightning struck, lounging alongside Jefferson and offering witty consolations as the Continental Congress edited out several of Jefferson's most cherished passages, wearing a coonskin cap for his portrait in Paris, remarking, as the delegates signed the Constitution, that yes, the sun that was carved into the chair at the front of the room did now seem to be rising. In addition to seeming eternal, ubiquitous, protean, and endlessly quotable, Franklin had the most sophisticated sense of timing among all the prominent statesmen of the Revolutionary era. His forceful presence at the defining moment of 1776 had caused most observers to forget that, in truth, Franklin was a latecomer to the Patriot cause, the man who had spent most of the 1760s in London attempting to obtain, of all things, a royal charter for Pennsylvania. He had actually lent his support to the Stamp Act in 1765 and lobbied for a position within the English government as late as 1771. But he had leapt back across the Atlantic and onto the American side of the imperial debate in the nick of time, a convert to the cause, who, by the dint of his international reputation, was quickly catapulted into the top echelon of the political leadership. Sent to France to negotiate a wartime alliance, he arrived in Paris just when the French ministry was ready to entertain such an idea. He remained in place long enough to lead the American delegation through the peace treaty with England, then relinquished his ministerial duties to Jefferson in 1784, just when all diplomatic initiatives on America's behalf in Europe bogged down and proved futile. When asked if he was Franklin's replacement, Jefferson had allegedly replied that he was his successor, but that no one could replace him. He arrived back in Philadelphia a conquering hero, and in plenty of time to be selected as a delegate to the Constitutional Convention. This gift of exquisite timing continued until the very end. In April of 1787, Franklin agreed to serve as the new president of the revitalized Pennsylvania Abolition Society and to make the anti-slavery cause the final project of his life. Almost 60 years earlier, in 1729, as a young printer in Philadelphia, he had begun publishing Quaker tracts against slavery and the slave trade. Throughout the middle years of the century and into the Revolutionary era, he had lent his support to Anthony Benezet and other Quaker abolitionists, and he had spoken out on occasion against the claim that blacks were innately inferior or that racial categories were immutable. Nevertheless, while his anti-slavery credentials were clear, at one point Franklin had owned a few household slaves himself, and he had never made slavery a priority target or thrown the full weight of his enormous prestige against it. Starting in 1787, that changed. At the Constitutional Convention, he intended to introduce a proposal calling for the inclusion of a statement of principle condemning both the slave trade and slavery, thereby making it unequivocally clear that the founding document of the new American nation committed the government to eventual emancipation. But several Northern delegates, along with at least one officer in the Pennsylvania Abolition Society, persuaded him to withdraw his proposal on the grounds that it put the fragile sectional compromise, and therefore the Constitution itself, at risk. The petition submitted to the First Congress under his signature then was essentially the same proposal he had wanted to introduce at the convention. With the Constitution now ratified and the new federal government safely in place, Franklin resumed his plea that slavery be declared incongruous with the revolutionary principles on which the nation was founded. The man with the impeccable timing was choosing to make the anomaly of slavery the last piece of advice he would offer his country. Though his health was declining rapidly, newspaper accounts of the pro-slavery speeches in the House roused him for one final appearance in print. Under the pseudonym Historicus, he published a parody of the speech delivered by James Jackson of Georgia. It was a vintage Franklin performance, reminiscent of his bemused but devastating recommendations to the English government in 1770 about the surest means to take the decisive action guaranteed to destroy the British Empire. This time he claimed to have noticed the eerie similarity between Jackson's speech on behalf of slavery and one delivered a century earlier by an Algerian pirate named Sidi Mehemet Ibrahim. Surely the similarities were inadvertent, he suggested, since Jackson was obviously a virtuous man and thus incapable of plagiarism. But the arguments and the very language were identical, except that Jackson used Christianity to justify enslavement of the Africans, while the African used Islam to justify enslavement of Christians. The doctrine that plundering and enslaving the Christians is unjust is at best problematical, the Algerian had allegedly written, and when presented with a petition to cease capturing Europeans, he had argued to the Divan of Algiers that it is in the interest of the state to continue the practice, therefore let the petition be rejected. All the same practical objections to ending slavery were also raised. But who is to indemnify their masters for the loss? Will the state do it? Is our treasury sufficient? And if we set our slaves free, what is to be done with them? Our people will not pollute themselves by intermarrying with them. Franklin then had the Algerian argue that the enslaved Christians were better off with us rather than remain in Europe, where they would only cut each other's throats in religious wars. Franklin's pointed parody was reprinted in several newspapers from Boston to Philadelphia, though nowhere south of the Potomac. It was his last public act. 3 weeks later, on April 17th, the founding grandfather finally went to his maker. Prior to his passing, however, the great weight of Franklin's unequivocal endorsement made itself felt in the congressional debate and emboldened several northern representatives to answer the pro-slavery arguments of the Deep South with newfound courage. Franklin's reputation served as the catalyst in an exchange as Smith of South Carolina attempted to discredit his views by observing that even great men have their senile moments. This prompted rebuttals from the Pennsylvania delegation. Instead of proving him superannuated, Franklin's anti-slavery views showed that the qualities of his soul, as well as those of his mind, are yet in their vigor. Only Franklin still seemed able to speak the language of America and to call us back to our first principles. Critics of Franklin, it was suggested, only exposed the absurdity of the pro-slavery position, revealing clearly that an advocate for slavery in its fullest latitude at this stage of the world and on the floor of the American Congress, too, is a phenomenon in politics. They defy, yea, mock all belief. William Scott of Pennsylvania, his blood also up in defense of Franklin, launched a frontal assault on the constitutional position of the Deep South. I think it unsatisfactory to be told that there was an understanding between the northern and southern members in the National Convention. The Constitution was a written document, not a series of unwritten understandings. Where did it say anything at all about slavery? Who were these South Carolinians to instruct us on what Congress could and could not do? I believe, concluded Scott, if Congress should at any time be of the opinion that a state of slavery was a quality inadmissible in America, they would not be barred of prohibiting this baneful quality. He went on for nearly an hour. It turned out to be the high water mark of the anti-slavery effort in the House. In retrospect, Franklin's final gesture at leadership served to solidify his historic reputation as a man who possessed in his bones a feeling for the future. But in the crucible of the moment, another quite plausible definition of leadership was circulating in the upper reaches of the government. John Adams, for example, though an unspoken enemy of slavery, who could match his revolutionary credentials with anyone, concurred from his perch as presiding officer of the Senate when that body refused to permit the Quaker petitions to be heard. Alexander Hamilton, who was a founding member of the New York Manumission Society and a staunch anti-slavery advocate, also regretted the whole debate in the House, since it stymied his highest priority, which was approval of his financial plan. And George Washington, the supreme founding father, who had taken a personal vow never to purchase another slave, and let it be known that it was his fondest wish to see some plan adopted by which slavery in this country may be abolished by slow, sure, and imperceptible degrees, also concurred that the ongoing debate in the House was an embarrassing and dangerous nuisance that must be terminated. Jefferson probably agreed with this verdict, though his correspondence is characteristically quiet on the subject. The common version of leadership that bound this distinguished constellation together was a keen appreciation of the political threat that any direct consideration of slavery represented in the still fragile American Republic. And the man who stepped forward to implement this version of leadership was James Madison. If Franklin's great gift was an uncanny knack for levitating above political camps, operating at an altitude that permitted him to view the essential patterns and then comment with great irony and wit on the behavior of those groveling about on the ground, Madison's specialty was just the opposite. He lived in the details and worked his magic in the context of the moment, mobilizing those forces on the ground more adroitly and with a more deft tactical proficiency than anyone else. Taken together, he and Franklin would have made a nearly unbeatable team. But in 1790, they were on different sides. Madison's position on slavery captured the essence of what might be called the Virginia straddle. On the one hand, he found the blatantly pro-slavery arguments shamefully indecent, and described his colleagues from South Carolina and Georgia as intemperate beyond all example and even all decorum. Like most of his fellow Virginians, he wanted it known that he preferred an early end to the slave trade and regarded the institution of slavery a deep-rooted abuse. He claimed to be genuinely embarrassed at the stridently pro-slavery rhetoric of the delegates from the Deep South and much more comfortable on the high moral ground of his northern friends. But a fault line ran through the center of his thinking, a kind of mysterious region where ideas entered going in one direction, but then emerged headed the opposite way. For example, when urged by Benjamin Rush, the Philadelphia physician and abolitionist, to support the Quaker petitions in the House, Madison responded, "Although I feel the force of many of your remarks, I cannot embrace the idea to which they lead." When pressed to explain the discrepancy between his hypothetical anti-slavery position and his actual dedication to self-imposed paralysis, he tended to offer several different answers. Sometimes it was a matter of his Virginia constituents. "Those from whom I derive my public station," he explained, "are known by me to be greatly interested in that species of property and to view the matter in that light." Sometimes it was a matter of timing. He concurred with the progressive segment of Virginia's planter class that slavery is a moral and political evil, and that whoever brings forward in the respective states some general, rational, and liberal plan for the gradual emancipation of slaves will deserve well of his country. Yet I think it was very improper at this time to introduce it in Congress. Any effort to locate the core of Madison's position on slavery therefore misses the point, which is that there was no core, except perhaps the conviction that the whole subject was taboo. Like Jefferson and the other members of the Virginia dynasty, He regarded any explicit defense of slavery in the mode of South Carolina and Georgia as a moral embarrassment. On the other hand, he regarded any effort to end slavery as premature, politically impractical, and counterproductive. As a result, he developed a way of talking and writing about the problem that might be described as enlightened obfuscation. For example, consider the following Madisonian statement written during the height of the debate in the House. If this folly did not reproach the public councils, it ought to excite no regret in the patrons of humanity and freedom. Nothing could hasten more the progress of these reflections and sentiments which are secretly undermining the institution which this mistaken zeal is laboring to secure against the most distant approach of danger. The convoluted syntax, multiple negatives, indefinite antecedents, and masterful circumlocutions of this statement defy comprehension. What begins as a denunciation of those defending slavery somehow doubles back on itself and ends up in worrisome confusion that the matter is being talked about at all. What is meant to sound like an anti-slavery argument transforms itself in mid-passage into a verbal fog bank that descends over the entire subject like a cloud. In the midst of this willful confusion, one Madisonian conviction shone through with his more characteristic clarity, namely, that slavery was an explosive topic that must be removed from the political agenda of the new nation. It was taboo because it exposed the inherent contradictions of the Virginia position, which was much closer to the position of the Deep South than Madison wished to acknowledge, even to himself. And it was taboo because, more than any other controversy, it possessed the political potential to destroy the Union. Franklin wanted to put slavery onto the national agenda before it was too late to take decisive action in accord with the principles of the Revolution. Madison wanted to take slavery off the national agenda because he believed that decisive action would result in the destruction of either the Virginia planter class or the nation itself. In the minds of many Virginians, the two items were synonymous. The true policy of the Southern members, he explained to a fellow Virginian, was to let the affair proceed with as little noise as possible. The misguided representatives of the Deep South had spoiled that strategy. Now Madison resolved to seize the opportunity created by their threats of secession to put Congress on record as rejecting any constitutional right by the federal government to end slavery. It was the South Carolina solution achieved in the Virginia style. The essence of that style was in direction. Madison was its master, so deft behind the scenes and in unrecorded conversations that his most significant political achievements, including his impact on the eventual shape of the Constitution and his enduring influence on the thought and behavior of Thomas Jefferson, remain forever hidden, visible only in the way that one detects the movement of iron filings within a magnetic field. The Madisonian influence revealed itself in the House debate of March 23rd when the committee report came up for a vote. Something had changed. Several Northern members who had previously sided with the Quaker petitioners now expressed their regret that the matter had gotten out of hand. Fisher Ames of Massachusetts wondered out loud why the House had allowed itself to be drawn into a debate over abstract propositions, and now urged that the committee report be tabled. Jackson rose to thank Ames and his Northern colleagues for seeing the light and recovering the old conciliatory spirit that had once permitted Northern and Southern interests to cooperate. One of the Quaker petitioners in the gallery, John Pemberton, noted in his diary that some kind of sectional bargain had obviously been struck. "It was a matter of scratch me, and I will scratch thee." Pemberton surmised that a secret deal had been arranged whereby Massachusetts would align itself with the Deep South on the slavery issue in return for Southern support on assumption. If so, Jefferson's dinner party the following June was the culmination of an even more complicated sectional negotiation than previously realized. But all claims about what had gone on behind the scenes are conjectural. Madison seldom left footprints. The goal of the Deep South, now with support from Massachusetts and Virginia, was to have the committee report tabled, again threatening that further debate would risk disunion, which William Loudon Smith likened to heaving out an anchor to windward. Madison, however, wanted more than just an end to the debate. He wished to establish a precedent that clarified the constitutional ambiguities concerning the power of Congress over slavery. Therefore, he welcomed the positive vote, 29-25, to accept the committee report, details of which forthcoming, because he had resolved to use the occasion to establish a constitutional precedent. In the 20th century, what Madison aimed to achieve would have required a decision by the Supreme Court. But in 1790, the Supreme Court was a woefully weak third branch of the federal government, and the principle of judicial review had yet to be established. Madison wanted to use the vote on the committee report to create the equivalent of a landmark decision prohibiting any national scheme for emancipation. It happened just as he desired. The committee report consisted of 7 resolutions that addressed this salient question. What are the powers vested in Congress under the present Constitution relating to the abolition of slavery? The first resolution was designed to appease the Deep South by confirming that the Constitution prohibited any federal legislation limiting or ending the slave trade until 1808. The fourth was a gesture toward the Northern interests, authorizing Congress to levy a tax on slave imports designed to discourage the practice without prohibiting it. The seventh was a nod toward the Quaker petitioners, declaring that in all cases to which the authority of Congress extends, they will exercise it for the humane objects of the memorialists so far as they can be promoted on the principles of justice, humanity, and good policy. But what did this deliberately vague promise mean? Specifically, how far did the authority of Congress extend? The implicit answer was in the second resolution. It read that Congress, by a fair construction of the Constitution, are equally restrained from interfering in the emancipation of slaves who already are or who may, within the period mentioned, be imported into or born within any of the said states. This was the key provision. In keeping with the compromise character of the committee report, it gave the Deep South the protection it had demanded by denying congressional authority to pass any gradual emancipation legislation. But it also set a chronological limit to this moratorium. The prohibition would only last within the period mentioned, that is, until 1808. In effect, the committee report extended the deadline for the consideration of emancipation to bring it into line with the deadline for the end of the slave trade. The Deep South would get its way, but only for a limited time. After 1808, Congress possessed the authority to do what it wished. Then all constitutional restraints would lapse. At this decisive moment, the Madisonian magic worked its will. The House went into committee of the whole to revise the language of the report. In parliamentary maneuverings of this sort, Madison had no peer. The Virginia delegation had already received its marching orders to mobilize behind an amended version of the report, and several northern delegations, chiefly those of Massachusetts and New York, had clearly been lobbied to support the amendments, though no one will ever know what promises were made. In the end, the 7 resolutions were reduced to 3. The tax on the slave trade was dropped altogether, as was the 7th resolution, with its vague declaration of solidarity with the benevolent goals of the Quaker petitioners. The latter gesture had become irrelevant because of the new language of the 2nd resolution. It now read, "The Congress have no authority to interfere in the emancipation of slaves or in the treatment of them within any of the states, it remaining with the several states alone to provide any regulation therein which humanity and true policy may require." During the debate over this language, Madison provided the clearest gloss on its fresh meaning by explaining that instead of imposing an 18-year moratorium on congressional action against slavery, the amendment made it unconstitutional to attempt to manumit them at any time. The final report passed by the House in effect placed any and all debate over slavery as it existed in the South out of bounds forever. What had begun as an initiative to put slavery on the road to extinction had been transformed into a decision to extinguish all federal plans for emancipation. By a vote of 29-25, the House agreed to transcribe this verdict in the permanent record. A relieved George Washington wrote home to a Virginia friend that "the slave business has at last been put to rest and will scarce awake." As usual, Washington was right. Congress had moved gradual emancipation off its political agenda. Its decision in the spring of 1790 became a precedent with the force of common law. In November of 1792, for example, when another Quaker petition came forward under the sponsorship of Fisher Ames, William Loudon Smith referred his colleague to the earlier debate of 1790. The House had then decided never again to allow itself to become inflamed by the mere rant and rhapsody of a meddling fanatic, and had argued that the subject would never be stirred again. The petition was withdrawn. Over 40 years later, in 1833, Daniel Webster cited the same precedent. "My opinion of the powers of Congress on the subject of slaves and slavery is that Congress has no authority to interfere in the emancipation of slaves. This was so resolved by the House in 1790, and I do not know of a different opinion since." Whatever window of opportunity had existed to complete the one glaring piece of unfinished business in the Revolutionary era was now closed. As noted earlier, perhaps the window, if in fact there ever was a window, had already closed by 1790, so the debate and decision in the House merely sealed shut what the formidable combination of racial demography, Anglo-Saxon presumptions, and entrenched economic interests had already foreclosed. Over 200 years after the event, it is still not possible to demonstrate conclusively that Madison's understanding of the political priorities was wrong, or that the pursuit of Franklin's priorities would not have dismembered the American Republic at the moment of its birth. Perhaps it was inevitable, even preferable, that slavery as a national problem be moved from the Congress to the churches, where it could come under scrutiny as a sin requiring a national purging rather than as a social dilemma requiring a political solution. That, in any event, is what happened. One can only speculate on what thoughts and feelings went streaking through the conscience of James Madison after the fleeting moment passed. Madison understood better than most what was at stake in the debate over slavery. He knew what the American Revolution had promised, that slavery violated that promise, and that Franklin had gone to his maker reminding all concerned that silence was a betrayal of the revolutionary legacy. During the memorial service in Franklin's honor on April 22nd, Madison rose to deliver the final tribute of the House. The House being informed of the decease of Benjamin Franklin, a citizen whose native genius was not more an ornament to human nature than his various exertions of it have been precious to science, to freedom, and to his country, to resolve as a mark of the veneration due to his memory that the members wear the customary badge of mourning for 1 month. The symbolism of the scene was poignant, dramatizing as it did the passing of the prototypical American and the cause of gradual emancipation. Whether they knew it or not, the badge of mourning the members of the House agreed to wear also bore testimony to the tragic and perhaps intractable problem that even the revolutionary generation, with all its extraordinary talent, could neither solve nor face. Chapter 4. The Farewell. Throughout the first half of the 1790s, the closest approximation to a self-evident truth in American politics was George Washington. A legend in his own time, Americans had been describing Washington as the father of the country since 1776, which is to say before there was even a country. By the time he assumed the presidency in 1789, no other candidate was even thinkable, the mythology surrounding Washington's reputation had grown like ivy over a statue, effectively covering the man with an aura of omnipotence, rendering the distinction between his human qualities and his heroic achievements impossible to delineate. Some of the most incredible stories also happened to be true. During General Edward Braddock's ill-fated expedition against the French outside Pittsburgh in 1755, a young Washington had joined with Daniel Boone to rally the survivors, despite having two horses shot out from under him and multiple bullet holes piercing his coat and creasing his pants. At Yorktown in 1781, he had insisted on standing atop a parapet for a full 15 minutes during an artillery attack, bullets and shrapnel flying all about him, defying aides who tried to pull him down before he had properly surveyed the field of action. When Washington spoke of destiny, people listened. If there was a Mount Olympus in the new American Republic, all the lesser gods were gathered farther down the slope. The only serious contender for primacy was Benjamin Franklin, but just before his death in 1790, Franklin himself acknowledged Washington's supremacy. In a characteristically Franklin-esque gesture, he bequeathed to Washington his Crabtree walking stick, presumably to assist the general in his stroll toward immortality. "If it were a scepter," Franklin remarked, "he has merited it and would become it." In the America of the 1790s, Washington's image was everywhere, in paintings, prints, lockets, on coins, silverware, plates, and household bric-a-brac. And his familiarity seemed forever. His commanding presence had been the central feature in every major event of the Revolutionary era, the linchpin of the Continental Army throughout 8 long years of desperate fighting from 1775 to 1783, the presiding officer at the Constitutional Convention in 1787, the first and only chief executive of the fledgling federal government since 1789. He was the palpable reality that clothed the revolutionary rhapsodies in flesh and blood, America's one and only indispensable character. Washington was the core of gravity that prevented the American Revolution from flying off into random orbits, the stable center around which the revolutionary energies formed. As one popular toast of the day put it, he was the man who unites all hearts. He was the American Zeus, Moses, and Cincinnatus all rolled into one. Then, all of a sudden, on September 19, 1796, an article addressed to the people of the United States appeared on the inside pages of the American Daily Advertiser, Philadelphia's major newspaper. The conspicuous austerity of the announcement was matched by its calculated simplicity. It began, "Friends and fellow citizens, the period for a new election of a citizen to administer the executive government of the United States being not far distant, it appears to me proper, especially as it may conduce to a more distinct expression of the public voice, that I should now apprise you of the resolutions I have formed, to decline being considered among the number of those out of whom a choice is to be made." It ended, again in a gesture of ostentatious moderation, with the unadorned signature, G. Washington, United States. Every major newspaper in the country reprinted the article over the ensuing weeks, though only one, the Courier of New Hampshire, gave it the title that would echo through the ages, Washington's Farewell Address. Contemporaries began to debate its contents almost immediately, and a lively and ultimately silly argument soon ensued about whether Washington or Hamilton actually wrote it. Over a longer stretch of time, the farewell address achieved transcendental status, ranking alongside the Declaration of Independence and the Gettysburg Address as a seminal statement of America's abiding principles. Its Olympian tone made it a perennial touchstone at those political occasions requiring platitudinous wisdom. And in the late 19th century, the Congress made its reading a mandatory ritual on Washington's birthday. Meanwhile, several generations of historians, led by students of American diplomacy, have made the interpretation of the farewell address into a cottage industry of its own, building up a veritable mountain of commentary around its implications for an isolationist foreign policy and a bipartisan brand of American statecraft. But in the crucible of the moment, none of these subsequent affectations or interpretations mattered much, if at all. What did matter, indeed struck most readers as the only thing that truly mattered, was that George Washington was retiring. The constitutional significance of the decision, of course, struck home immediately, signaling, as it did, Washington's voluntary surrender of the presidency after two terms, thereby setting the precedent that held firm until 1940, when Franklin Delano Roosevelt broke it. It was reaffirmed in 1951 with passage of the 22nd Amendment. But even that landmark precedent, so crucial in establishing the Republican principle of rotation in office, paled in comparison to an even more elemental political and psychological realization. For 20 years, over the entire lifespan of the Revolutionary War and the experiment with Republican government, Washington had stood at the helm of the ship of state. Now he was sailing off into the sunset. The precedent he was setting may have seemed uplifting in retrospect, but at the time, the glaring and painful reality was that the United States without Washington was itself unprecedented. The farewell address, as several commentators have noted, was an oddity in that it was not really an address. It was never delivered as a speech. It should, by all rights, be called the farewell letter, for it was, in form and tone, an open letter to the American people, telling them they were now on their own. Insiders had suspected that this was coming for about 6 months. In February of 1796, Washington had first approached Alexander Hamilton about drafting some kind of valedictory statement. Shortly thereafter, the gossip network inside the government had picked up the scent. By the end of the month, James Madison was writing James Monroe in Paris, "It is pretty certain that the president will not serve beyond his present term." On the eve of the farewell address, the Federalist leader from Massachusetts, Fisher Ames, predicted that Washington's looming announcement would constitute a signal like dropping a hat for the party races to start. But, in fact, they had been going on unofficially throughout the preceding spring and summer. In May, for example, Madison had speculated, correctly it turned out, that in the first contested election for president in American history, Jefferson would probably be the object on one side, and Adams, apparently, on the other. By midsummer, Washington himself was apprising friends of his earnest desire to leave the government when his term was up, after which No consideration under heaven that I can foresee shall again withdraw me from the walks of private life." He had been dropping hints in truth throughout his second term, describing himself as on the advanced side of the grand climacteric, and too old for the rigors of the job, repeating his familiar refrain about the welcome solace of splendid isolation beneath his vine and fig tree at Mount Vernon. But did he mean it? Lamentations about the tribulations of public life, followed by celebrations of the bucolic splendor of retirement to rural solitude, had become a familiar, even formulaic posture within the leadership class of the revolutionary generation, especially within the Virginia dynasty. Everyone knew the classical models of latter-day seclusion represented by Cincinnatus and described by Cicero and Virgil. Declarations of principled withdrawal from the hurly-burly of politics to the natural rhythms of one's fields or farms had become rhetorical rituals. If Washington's retirement hymn featured the vine and fig tree, Jefferson's idolized my family, my farm, and my books. The motif had become so commonplace that John Adams, an aspiring Cicero himself, claimed that the Virginians had worn out the entire Ciceronian syndrome. "It seems the mode of becoming great is to retire," he wrote Abigail in 1796. "It is marvelous how political plants grow in the shade." Washington had been threatening to retire even before he was inaugurated as president in 1789, and he repeated the threat in 1792 prior to his re-election. While utterly sincere on all occasions, his preference for a virtuous retirement had always been trumped by a more public version of virtue, itself reinforced by the unanimous judgment of his political advisers that he and he alone was indispensable. Why expect a different conclusion in 1796? The short answer? Age. Throughout most of his life, Washington's physical vigor had been one of his most priceless assets. A notch below 6'4" and slightly above 200 pounds, he was a full head taller than his male contemporaries. John Adams claimed that the reason Washington was invariably selected to lead every national effort was that he was always the tallest man in the room. A detached description of his physical features would have made him sound like an ugly, misshapen oaf. Pockmarked face, decayed teeth, oversized eye sockets, massive nose, heavy in the hips, gargantuan hands and feet. But somehow, when put together and set in motion, the full package conveyed sheer majesty. As one of his biographers put it, his body did not just occupy space, it seemed to organize the space around it. He dominated a room not just with his size, but with an almost electric presence. "He has so much martial dignity in his deportment," observed Benjamin Rush, "that there is not a king in Europe but would look like a valet de chambre by his side." Not only did bullets and shrapnel seem to veer away from his body in battle, not only did he once throw a stone over the natural bridge in the Shenandoah Valley, which was 215 feet high, not only was he generally regarded as the finest horseman in Virginia, the rider who led the pack in most fox hunts, he also possessed for most of his life a physical constitution that seemed immune to disease or injury. Other soldiers came down with frostbite after swimming ice-choked rivers. Other statesmen fell by the wayside, lacking the stamina to handle the relentless political pressure. Washington suffered none of these ailments. Adams said that Washington had the gift of taciturnity, meaning he had an instinct for the eloquent silence. This same principle held true on the physical front. His medical record was eloquently empty. The inevitable chinks in his cast-iron constitution began to appear with age. He fell ill just before the Constitutional Convention in 1787 and almost missed that major moment. Then, in 1790, soon after assuming the presidency, he came down with influenza, then raging in New York, and nearly died from pulmonary complications. Jefferson's statements about Washington were notoriously contradictory and unreliable, as we shall see, but he dated Washington's physical decline from this moment. The firm tone of his mind for which he had been remarkable was beginning to relax. A listlessness of labor, a desire for tranquility had crept on him, and a willingness to let others act or even think for him. In 1794, while touring the terrain around the new national capital that would bear his name, he badly wrenched his back while riding. After a career of galloping to hounds and a historic reputation as America's premier man on horseback, he was never able to hold his seat in the saddle with the same confidence. As he moved into his mid-60s, the muscular padding around his torso softened and sagged. His erect bearing started to tilt forward as if he were always leaning into the wind, and his energy flagged by the end of each long day. Hostile newspaper editorials spoke elliptically of encroaching senility. Even his own vice president, John Adams, conceded that Washington seemed dazed and wholly scripted at certain public ceremonies, like an actor reading his lines or an aging athlete going through the motions. Perhaps age alone would have been sufficient to propel Washington down the road from Philadelphia to Mount Vernon one last time. Surely, if anyone deserved to spend his remaining years relaxing under his vine and fig tree, it was Washington. Perhaps, in that eerily instinctive way in which he always grasped the difference between the essential and the peripheral, he literally felt in his bones that another term as president meant that he would die in office. By retiring when he did, he avoided that fate, which would have established a precedent that smacked of monarchical longevity by permitting biology to set the terminus of his tenure. Our obsession with the two-term precedent obscures the more elemental principle established by Washington's voluntary retirement, namely, that the office would routinely outlive the occupant, that the American presidency was fundamentally different from a European monarchy, that presidents, no matter how indispensable, were inherently disposable. But advancing age and sheer physical fatigue were only part of the answer. Perhaps the most succinct way to put it is that Washington was leaving office not just because he was hearing whispers of mortality, but also because he was wounded. What no British bullet could do in the Revolutionary War, the opposition press had managed to do in the political battles during his second term. In the wake of his farewell address, for example, an open letter appeared in Benjamin Franklin Bache's Aurora, in which the old firebrand Tom Paine celebrated Washington's departure, actually prayed for his imminent death, then predicted that the world will be puzzled to decide whether you are an apostate or an impostor, whether you have abandoned good principles or whether you ever had any. Some of the articles were utterly preposterous, like the charge also made in the Aurora that recently obtained British documents from the wartime years revealed that Washington was secretly a traitor who had fully intended to sell out the American cause until Benedict Arnold beat him to the punch. His critics, it should also be noted, were a decided minority, vastly outnumbered by his countless legions of supporters. The rebuttals to Paine's open letter, for example, appeared immediately, describing Paine as that noted sot and infidel, whose efforts to despoil Washington's reputation resembled the futile efforts of a reptile infusing its venom into the Atlantic or ejecting its filthy saliva toward the sun. Paine's already questionable reputation, in fact, never recovered from this episode. Taking on Washington was the fastest way to commit political suicide in the Revolutionary era. Nevertheless, The attacks had been a persistent feature of his second term, and despite his customarily impenetrable front, Washington was deeply hurt by them. But these attacks, unjust and unpleasant as they are, will occasion no change in my conduct, nor will they work any other effect in my mind, he postured. Although Washington was not, like Adams or Jefferson, a prodigious reader of books, he was an obsessive reader of newspapers. He subscribed to 10 papers at Mount Vernon. His pose of utter disregard was just that, a pose. Malignity, therefore, may dart her shafts, he explained, but no earthly power can deprive me of the consolation of knowing that I have not been guilty of willful error, however numerous they may have been from other causes. This outwardly aloof but blatantly defensive tone seemed to acknowledge, in its backhanded way, that his critics had struck a nerve. The main charge levied against Washington was that he had made himself into a quasi-king. "We have given him the powers and prerogatives of a king," claimed one New York editorial. "He holds levees like a king, receives congratulations on his birthday like a king, employs his old enemies like a king, shuts himself up like a king, shuts up other people like a king, takes advice of his counselors or follows his own opinions like a king." Several of these charges were patently false. The grain of truth in them, on the other hand, involved Washington's quite conspicuous embodiment of authority. He had no compunction about driving around Philadelphia in an ornate carriage drawn by 6 cream-colored horses, or, when on horseback, riding a white stallion with a leopard cloth and gold-trimmed saddle, or accepting laurel crowns at public celebrations that resembled coronations. It also did not help that when searching for a substitute for the toppled statue of George III in New York City, citizens chose a wooden replica of Washington, encouraging some critics to refer to him as George IV. In a sense, it was a problem of language. Since there had never been a Republican chief executive, there was no readily available vocabulary to characterize such a creature, except the verbal traditions that had built up around European courts and kings. In another sense, it was a problem of personality. Washington was an inherently stiff and formal man who cultivated aloofness and possessed distancing mechanisms second to none. This contributed to his sense of majesty, true enough, but pushed an increment further, the majestic man became his majesty. Beyond questions of appearance or language or personal